right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Our show today is one I'm really, really looking forward to. I know I always say that, but this is especially true today. At the back end of the show, I'm going to be talking with people about something I want people to really think about, to take up, and to do. All right, and that's it has a lot to do with what Samuel Jackson challenged people to do in the midst of this wanton murder, this savage brutality that's being brought down on black and brown people, especially youth all over the country, and in an increasing manner, it seems, okay? That's going to be at the back end of the show. Before that, we'll be talking with Maria Flores. Maria is the cousin of Myra Cornejo, who was killed by the sheriffs in Compton on New Year's Eve, I think it was. She was gunned down at a gas station, and a brutal murder, and left five kids behind, and we'll get into her story with Maria Flores, who is her cousin. And Maria's been helping to organize protests and fight for justice for Myra. Before that, we'll be talking with Ron Kay. Ron's an attorney in Pasadena, California, who represented five prisoners at the LA County Men's Jail. The five prisoners filed suit after being beaten and tortured by sheriff's deputies. And Ron was the lawyer that won their case and also recently was awarded over $5 million in attorney's fees. And he's going to talk with us about the case and the significance of that decision. But opening the show up, I'm really happy to be welcoming back to the show Dwayne Booth, a.k.a. Mr. Fish. You know, I always have a lot of fun when I'm talking with Dwayne. I always have a lot of fun talking about what he does, about how we think about the world, all this stuff. But this time in particular, it's coming at a very, very important and heavy time. We're talking about the people at Charlie Hebdo, the magazine in Paris, who were wantonly slaughtered by religious maniacs. Okay, fundamentalists. And we're going to be talking with Fish about why cartoons can inspire and change minds and why they can also enrage the powers that be and how he's looking at this whole scene with the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here, although the circumstances are not so thrilling.
Yeah. Well, it's actually, you know, it really says a lot about where we're at in the world today. And I wanted to talk with you about that because you've written a little bit about that. Give people your take on the whole scene.
Well, it's really a shame that cartoonists and satirists have been brought to the fore in the news because of the way they died rather than the way they have been living for centuries. As a profession, it's really lost a lot of its heat and its significance to a lot of people, which is really, really sad. I mean, the Charlie Hebdo was not doing so great financially. It was considered to be on its last legs. A lot of people were surprised to find out that many of the cartoonists were in their 70s. These weren't young hipsters. These were people trying to bring to the 21st century the greatness of satire, and particularly what came out of the underground comics movement, trying to bring that to the contemporary times. And they weren't doing that great. So, again, it's sad that this is why we're talking about it. Well, let me put it this way. Let's come at it a different way. When the news broke, and it was definitely, you know, very horrifying and upsetting, part of me at the same time said, I'm jealous that there's nothing in this country, in the United States, that mirrors that situation in the sense, not the murder, but the existence of a publication that has cartoonists and satire happening with enough people where you can have an editorial meeting. They were killed at their editorial meeting. So part of me was just like, you know what? I used to go to editorial meetings when I was making, you know, a living doing cartoons. That doesn't exist in this country. So if you look at the numbers of cartoonists able to support themselves, particularly in this country, it has been disappearing for decades. In fact, let me just give you a very interesting statistic that I discovered when I was writing my most recent book. The Herb Bloch Foundation, Herb Bloch being one of the greatest cartoonists that is considered of the 20th century, who used to cartoon for the Chicago Tribune, that foundation did a study, and it was determined that at the turn of the 20th century, there were approximately 2,000 full-time working cartoonists, staff cartoonists. The study ended and gave numbers for the number that are able to make that claim in 2012, and it was fewer than 40. And now it's estimated to be fewer than 20. So if you look at those numbers alone, you can see that as a population, we're an endangered species. Cartoonists are going away, and it's a tragedy.
Well, let me ask you this, because it's, you know, I was actually stunned by that statistic when I read it in a couple places. I read it in your book, part of what I was able to read with your book, which, by the way, I want people to know the book is actually very, very interesting. And it's I started reading it last night because I had some trouble just with the technology getting it, but I finally did it. And the book is called, it's called Warning, Graphic Content. And it's a book that examines the past, present, and future of art as commentary. And it's really a fascinating book, really learning a lot as I read it. And we'll have you back to talk about that in the near future. But, you know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about is, beyond the state of the comic arts in the world today, there is this question of something much bigger was happening. I mean, this wasn't a layoff. These guys were killed, attacked, and killed for specific reasons, you know, and it says a lot about what we view in the world. And there's a real polarization about how do you respond to that? How do you assess that, you know? So I wanted to ask you about that, because you're in the middle. You're not somebody who, you know, your work, and I know your work very well, your work is not one of those things where people go, oh, ho, ho, chuckle, chuckle. It's not like reading High and Lois, you know, back in the 1950s or something, you know. It's not like reading Andy Capp even, you know. It's actually, there's something that you do. And I think that is related to why this attack on Charlie Hebdo.
I think it's a really interesting point and an important point to bring up, because I do think that when it comes right down to it, if you want to have a simplistic a box to put fundamentalism in, It's really a lack of imagination. That's how I see extremism. It's a lack of imagination. And for cartoonists and the arts to thrive, it demands that you have something of an imagination. As we move forward in time, it seems that, you know, many societies and cultures are, self-preservation is becoming more and more important. With the commodification of so much that goes on in the world, everything is being reduced to a lot of shorthand. And when it comes to cartoons, and particularly cartoons that Charlie was publishing, it begins with a slap in the face. If people want to know the history of that magazine, it used to be called Harry Carey through the 60s, which is a very great title, I think. And the reason is because cartooning then, like I said, was coming out of the underground comics movement, which was you get attention with a lewd... It's basically like you can't say that. Oh, yes, I can, and here it is. And there was a tradition with that it actually began conversations. But now it seems to it's the end of conversations. There's no deepening of any understanding between any groups. With Charlie, it wasn't just Islam that was being poked at. They went after Jewish people, you know, there were anti-American sentiments in there. And a lot of the conversation coming out of this situation is interesting, because there are a lot of people saying, yes, we mourn for the families and the victims of this horrible tragedy, and it shouldn't have happened. But, and then there's this but that comes that says, when you kick at a hornet's nest, you're going to get stung.
Hmm.
Right?
Hmm.
So it, all of a sudden, it becomes this thing, well, yes, you should be able to do this. You have a legal right to be able to say what you want, but do you have a moral right? Because it upsets people. And that line is becoming where it used to be kind of fuzzy and it was okay to test it in public, it's becoming a much more firm wall. It's being very difficult. People don't want to even attempt to go through that wall anymore.
You know, it's interesting, because that questioning of morality is something that, I mean, look, this is a huge issue in the world today. In this country, it's a huge issue, and in the world. What kind of morality are we going to have? What kind of world are we going to have that based on that morality? And specifically, I mean, you make a point here where you talk about one's artistic prerogative to create a drawing that is critical or demeaning of an established religion or political ideology should never be construed to equate with kicking a hornet's nest, which you're just talking about. But
right.
It's something, there's something even more in terms of, you know, we can't be defensive around this. There's actually a point that we're exploring realities is very important in relation to art, in relation to political cartooning, to editorial cartooning. This particularly does something that you've referred to as rearranging realities. And like with your work, I mean, I've gone through your work many times and gone, what? This is, you know, because it's like, how did he get away with that? It was so right on point. I'm thinking of the few that you've done with the victims of the concentration camp, the survivors of the concentration camp, standing outside and holding signs supporting the people of Gaza, playing on an old photograph of when these people were found and released from the concentration camps. And now you've inserted these signs, and it makes people sit up straight. It's like an electric shock on your spinal cord.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because you're right to speak to that point. There's been a lot of talk following this incident that, okay, this is proof that Islam is a religion or a philosophy of hate, right? Mm-hmm. These are evil people that we need to kill. And this is justification. We see it, and it has to happen. A lot of people, even people from the left, says, yes, that mathematically makes sense. Nobody wants to extend the definition to include people who perhaps, you know, is American exceptionalism, is that a philosophy of hate? Because if you look at it, if this was a drone attack, it would be less, it might be horrific, but it would be less visceral to people's emotional centers because, you know, this had people running through, shooting at point-blank range. It was much more horrible. But then if the Counterpunch just released, I think it was this week, some statistics about how many people the U.S. has killed with drones in Pakistan. This is just in Pakistan since 2004, right? And it's estimated that 2,379 people have been killed by U.S. drones, and only 12% are victims that you can identify as being linked with any militant organizations. Now, if you look at those numbers, is that evil? Do we expand that to say, you know, this is a reason why America must be dismantled because of the evil it is perpetrating on innocent people in other parts of the world? And what cartoonists do, they have access to that information, so they can expand the understanding and deepen the conversation to a point where, yes, you're not going to be so lazy where you look at what happened with Charlie and say that this is proof that Islam is evil, and not be able to extend that anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Cartoonists and satirists expand the dialogue so that you are not going to be that narrow-minded.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dwayne Booth, also known as Mr. Fish, and he's known as Mr. Fish by people in L.A. in particular, but also all over the country with his books, with his drawing. His drawings appear in many, many places. Truth Dig. You've been in Harper's. You've been in The Nation magazine. You've been in Revolution newspaper. You've been in many, many places, too many to list right now. And he also has a new book out called Warning Graphic Content, and it's published by the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC with support from the Future of Journalism Foundation. Now, Dwayne, we have probably about maybe 7 more minutes, and I wanted to get into this a little bit more because you also talk about, and I thought this was really important, when you were talking about all these other people that are involved in this in a certain sense, who you can point to is like, well, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with this? One of the things I saw in your book was you talk some about these various Palestinians that have been executed, these cartoonists, I think Mohammed Sabahaneh and Najee Salim al-Ali, both of whom were killed by the hand of Israel was involved in them. And I thought it was very important to look at this thing about, speak to that a little bit, but then also how that talks about, what that says about the power of cartooning.
Well, it's interesting with the two examples that you gave because it's a similar situation where somebody was killed for drawing pictures, and there's nobody in this country that even knows what that story means. And I'm sure that if you told that story to the majority of people living in the United States, they would assume that there was some justification that we just don't know about. Whenever Israel is involved, as you know, when we're involved with things, there's always this understanding that it was justified for some reason, but it's not that important for us to really hear what that is because there's no justification. And to speak for, you know, the power of cartoons to be able to engender that much threat to the power structure, it just goes back to how people look at pictures. Pictures look much more like reality than words do. When you look at words, you essentially have to you have to construct the experience of what is being written about, and then you react to it. With pictures, it's much more experiential. It happens, and it goes right into your brain. And that can be dangerous. I also want to point out the fact that, you know, we're talking about artists and cartoonists who use satire and maybe fight the good fight, but there's plenty of examples through history where cartoonists have been the bad guys as well. It's also, as that kind of tool, it can be used to propagate a lot of stereotypes and engender a lot of hatred. So it is a shorthand. It's a shorthand that can either help somebody understand something in an easier way and then get into the meat of it, but it can also deter somebody from wanting to get into the meat of it. Mm-hmm. If you understand, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, now I want to talk about this, and this might be moving towards a conclusion, but there's two things here. One, you quote, and I thought this was great, you quote your hero, Lenny Bruce, and you say knowledge of syphilis, you have Bruce saying knowledge of syphilis is not instructions on how to get it or to get it. It's not instructing you to get it. Likewise, knowledge of an opposing point of view is not an instruction to eradicate it nor embrace it. And I thought that was important when we're talking about the role of cartooning, both positive and negative in terms of what it enforces. But generally, if you look at cartoons and exactly the impact that it has on people, the concentration of so many sharp points in a visual way that can be easily grasped on many different levels by different people, and assess this to be different things. And I wanted to talk about that. It's because it's not, it is this point, and it's the importance of breaking the silence, because that is what cartooning to me really does, is it does break the silence. And I think you've said that, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it does have the tradition of, you know, if you look at this, just the court jester. You know, the court jester was allowed to bring things up that if anybody else did, the king would have his head chopped off for saying it. So humor allows you sort of into the room. And as long as you're willing to just demonstrate yourself as a harmless clown, you're going to be allowed close to the king. It's fine. For a lot of artists, that's not a role that is terribly interesting. As an artist, you have a responsibility to serve an idea in the least political way as possible, because you're trying to get to the truth. There's no yet another parallel, just getting back to what I was saying about self-preservation. If you look at just journalism, because these people at the magazine were also considered journalists, that's what satire is, and that's what political cartooning is. If you're going to threaten power, it's best to stay away, as far away from the center of power as you can, to keep yourself honest. Yeah, otherwise, the equivalent is you have the White House press corps, right? And you have, you know, you could have feisty Helen Thomas asking hard questions of the president. But really, when you look at it, she might be the feistiest person in the room, but she's not asking hard questions. She's not trying to get to the real truth of things. Otherwise, if that was the job of somebody who was going to be in that room, then Michael Slate would be in there. Gore Vidal would have been in there. They would have been, you know, those are the questions that I want to find out. I'm not going to listen to Helen Thomas or anybody who's, you know, that close to the president in that press room. And the reason they don't ask the hard questions and try to get to the truth is because they want to be invited back the next day. Mm-hmm. And cartoonists aren't interested in that. Mm-hmm. Which is probably why we're becoming fewer and fewer in numbers, sadly.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because is it fewer and fewer in numbers, or is it fewer and fewer in numbers employed in a way that their voice can be reached? Because you talk about breaking the silence. There also seems to be a need to, there's a move on the other side to actually really silence the cartoonists.
Right. Yeah. I think it's happening hand in hand. I mean, in many ways, it's just myself as an example. There was one time when that's all I did. And now I have to have a regular full-time job because it's no longer something I can only do. And there is a real drain when you're doing something for 40 hours a week that is not your craft and your passion. It's your output is minimized. There's no two ways around it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but your wit and your insight is not minimized in general or in particular with the work that you do. And Duane, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And thank you for your work, man.
I always
tell you that.
Mike.
Sure. And we're going to have you back soon to talk about your book, because, as I said, I finally conquered technology and was able to download it and read it. So I'm beginning to read it. All right?
Absolutely. I'll be back.
All right, man. Take care, Duane.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Duane Booth, a cartoonist whose work is known by people all over the country. It's appeared in Truthdig, Harper's, Nation Magazine, Revolution Newspaper, L.A. Times, L.A. Weekly, and many other places. And we've been talking about the assault, this terrible assault, the terrible murders at Charlie Hebdo, the magazine in Paris. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Junior Wells with Prison Bars All Around Me. You know, that title alone is really a very powerful introduction to this next section of the show. Just recently, a federal judge awarded more than $5 million in legal fees to lawyers representing five inmates at an L.A. county jail who alleged brutality by deputies. And the inmates themselves won a jury award of $950,000 in damages. The jury award included $210,000 in punitive damages. And as I said, the lawyers were awarded more than $5 million in legal fees. And this was something that was astounding to a lot of people. And I have to say, it was something that was really well-deserved, and I was happy to see this. And joining us to talk about this is one of the lawyers involved in the case, and his name is Ron Kay. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. Let's talk about this. Explain to people what the case was and how it proceeded.
Well, in 2008, Men's Central Jail in Los Angeles was in the throes of systemic violence perpetrated by sheriff's deputies against inmates. Inmates were getting, as one witness stated, the ass whooping of the day. I mean, repeatedly having bones broken, being tasered for no reason, and the use of pepper spray. And it was to such a level that a citizens commission was created by the County of Los Angeles to investigate what was going on. In 2008, my clients were in the 3100, 3300 block of Men's Central Jail, which is reserved for, as the county presented in their case, the worst of the worst, people with who represented the highest risk, according to the Sheriff's Department. And our clients engaged in civil disobedience. They yelled and screamed. They broke their sinks and threw pieces of porcelain around the hallways and flooded their cells because a very slight young man had been so severely beaten. It was August 25th, 2008. As a result, the deputies engaged in what they call an extraction. An extraction is not extraction of a tooth. It's they go in physically with body armor, shields, weapons, and remove inmates from their cells. But they didn't just remove them. They gave them, you know, a level of brutal punishment that is unconscionable, is something that is not to be tolerated in a civilized society. So we took this case, myself and several other attorneys, and decided to sue the County of Los Angeles and sue these deputies. They were 30 independent defendant deputies. It was a huge endeavor, and we were in trial for 5 weeks in October, November of 2013, and we were successful. Not only were we successful by showing liability from a legal perspective, but we showed that there was cruel and unusual punishment deserving of punitive damages against the supervisors. And it was just a triumph for these inmates who were so brutalized and who had very little to look forward to in their life. And now they have some damages coming to them and their families and a sense of justice.
Now, one of the things that has been reported, and I think they actually referred to you making a statement as well, that these were outrageous violations and resulted in outrageous injuries, as you're describing here, you're pointing to here. You gave the sense of the outrageous violations, but what about the outrageous injuries? And there was one person in particular that I know news reports focused on was Heriberto Rodriguez. And what does it mean? What give people a sense of what were the outrageous injuries? And if you wanted to expand on what were the outrageous violations, what's the character of them, that would be good too.
Well, the injuries stem from broken eye orbits to a level where people are seeing double vision and suffering epileptic seizures, broken legs, fractures of the skulls, and also there was alleged and there was testimony of like torturous conduct where tasers that were emitting serious electric shock were being imposed upon very delicate areas like the mucosal membranes of the buttocks, etc. And so it's akin to an Abu Ghraib-like situation. And the violations are the conduct that triggered these injuries was ruthless. And further, there was deception, the false reporting of what occurred. We were able to demonstrate that there were more videotapes because they were under policy, required to videotape what occurred in the cell. There were videotapes of the extractions that were lost or destroyed, so there wouldn't be a track record. It wouldn't be a record for accountability. So, I mean, it's the kind of nightmare that you would envision happening in some totalitarian regime, but it was happening right downtown in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really got me when I was reading about it, the attorneys for the sheriffs actually argued that this was all within policy and all done under the supervision of official supervisors were there when all this was being carried out.
That's right. What was so interesting is that the actual captain Daniel Cruz, who has been admonished and who has now left the department, he was admonished by the Citizens Commission, a commission headed by 5 federal judges. He was actually present on the tiers. And there were videos, not necessarily pointing inside the cells, but there were videos per regulation where the screams of anguish are just permeating the hallways. And there's Captain Cruz just listening what's going on. The jury rightfully imposed punitive damages against all of the supervisors that day.
Now, one of the things, and I know you were involved in a case around this as well, one of the things is that they've also talked about, it seems like the policy, the whole idea of this, extended to visitors to the prison as well. And you were involved in a case a couple years ago and won that case. And that was, as I remember, was very similar in terms of the brutality of it.
Yeah, that case was somewhat Twilight Zone-esque as well. In that case, a visitor came into the visiting section to visit his brother, and the deputy sensed some disrespect. They took him into a small room in the back of the jail, and 5 of them beat the living daylights out of him. They fabricated charges against him, writing false reports, which manifest in him being prosecuted, where he could face up to 14 years in prison. I had to represent him in the criminal case against the district attorney's office, but luckily we were able to find sufficient exculpatory evidence that they were lying so that they dismissed those charges. And then I filed my civil rights suit. And thankfully, the U.S. Attorney's Office is now prosecuting these actual deputies who not only beat the crap out of my client, but 4 other visitors. And they're being prosecuted, and their trial is set for March of 2015.
Now, I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with attorney Ron Kay, and we're talking about some of the horrors that are being inflicted on prisoners down at the L.A. County Jail. Now, Ron, one of the things I wanted to ask you, when you're looking at this and you're thinking about, okay, there's been a lot of things about the sheriffs and the deputies in the prisons and all this stuff, and one of the things was it was so bad that a commission actually did say that this was a culture of violence operating in the prisons. Can we talk about that?
Well, as part of our litigation strategy, we sued the county for its perpetuation of a pattern and practice of violence. And we were able to access extraordinary documentation about the lack of punishment, that people would be repeat offenders again and again and again, engaging in would be serious use of force. And it was generally the word of the deputy versus the victim who was suffering from some terrible injury. And at the end of the day, the sheriff's department uniformly said that the victim's complaint of excessive force was unfounded. And that type of conduct clearly perpetuated a sense of impunity, that sheriff's deputies never believed that anything could ever occur to them, especially when you had a captain who, from all indicia, seemed to have been supporting a tough hand. So I think the characterization of a culture of violence was absolutely correct.
You know, one of the things that I can't help but think back on is when you think about the Linwood Vikings in the Linwood Sheriff Station, part of this thing about the culture of violence flourishing in the prisons was actually indicated that there were also gangs among the guards. And I know there was like some Christmas party where they had a big gang fight among the guards. But on one level, you think, oh, God, OK, that's absurdly funny in a certain way. But then you think about what's going on there. And I remember the horror that the Linwood sheriffs brought down on people that were brought to the Linwood Sheriff Station and held there.
fortunately, I was a baby lawyer, and I was on that team back in 1993 or something that was suing the sheriff's department under Sherman Block as the sheriff and focusing on the Linwood Vikings, which was, at that juncture, I think the largest class action ever filed for a police abuse case in the history of the United States. But clearly the sheriff's department has a history, and Merrick Bob, who has been the independent auditor of the sheriff's department, has been articulating this for years. The sheriff's department has a history of rogue deputies engaged in misconduct. But I am very hopeful that a new dawn has arisen, that the Citizens Commission, lawsuits like my case, the Rodriguez case, scrutiny from the county supervisors, and most importantly, the election of Sheriff McDonnell, I think things are going to change. I'm always an optimist, and I really hope things are going to change now, because he's committed to reform, Sheriff McDonnell. I really believe that, and he was actually on the Citizens Commission. He was a standing member of that commission, so things change. I think the LAPD has changed a lot since the Daryl Gates years, and I'm really hopeful that the travesties that occurred in the Sheriff's Department will soon become history.
Well, we'll probably have you back to talk about that in the future, too, because I don't have the same kind of faith that you do in that. And looking at just the way that this stuff comes down nationally as well as particularly in L.A. But one of the things in relation to this stuff I wanted to ask you, because I think this is very, very important in relation to the idea that getting this, I know there was a big deal made out of this $5.4 million in legal fees awarded to the lawyers. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the significance of that, because here's the thing. I know you guys had said, okay, we're willing to settle for far less than what you ended up getting, but it was sort of, they kept pushing that they're going to go ahead with this. They're going to go ahead with this and fight it. And yet it basically came back and hit him in the head. And so I wanted to talk about the significance of a settlement this high for lawyers' fees, regardless of whether they end up taking the, you know, they're fighting the actual payment or not. But the fact that this statement was made, what's the significance of this?
The significance is huge. The civil rights statutes, both in California and under federal law, they enable an attorney takes on a civil rights case to be compensated for reasonable fees. We are committed to representing the rights of people in custody first and foremost. We committed ourselves to this case, and we have, you know, rent to pay and mortgages to pay. We have our own families, and we were living on contingency, trying to pay for all of our experts and all these other aspects of our case. And we did present to the county a reasonable settlement offer, and they rejected it. I would not be overstating it to say that this is probably the hardest fought case that I have ever encountered. I would even speculate that there are very few cases that have been as hard fought, because there's, for the lawyers out there, there's over 700 docket entries. Every single thing was litigated by the County of Los Angeles. The level of acrimony was extraordinary, and it just kept increasing the impossibility of settling the case without taking into consideration the attorney's fees. And ultimately, I gave up opportunities for retained cases, highly lucrative, because I was sacrificing or committing all my time to this case. And at the end of the day, it's a wake-up bell for the County of Los Angeles. This case should have been settled. This case was a case where the egregiousness of the acts of the deputies, the brutality, the deception, it was there. I brought it out to the county and asked them, we understand there's big risk for everyone, but let's move forward. And they just completely ignored, and it was a rebuff of our attempt. So I think that this case shows the County of Los Angeles, shows the world, that you cannot simply ignore the testimony of inmates saying that a jury won't believe them. A jury not only believed that these egregious acts happened, but they believed that it was cruel and unusual punishment triggering punitive damages. So I think the ripple effects of this are only positive for a safer and more civil prison population.
One of the things that sort of really struck me was that when you think about the significance of this, here you have a population that's undergoing all the things that you described, this culture of violence that flourishes there, all the horrendous treatment that they get, and the fact that they have very little recourse. The fact, I think Peter Eliasberg mentioned that there was 99.9% of the prisoners who are the people in jail do not have the ability to pay a lawyer, a private lawyer, to actually take up a case. This is not like a criminal court where you have the right to an attorney to do this. These are civil cases that are filed. And so if you can't afford to pay a lawyer, you're up a creek unless the lawyer actually is someone like you or someone who can say, this looks like a pretty positive case. You know, so you're either dedicated or you're sure that you're going to get this. But this kind of award actually, I think, says something about people's ability to stand up and take this on, including not just the prisoners, but having the courage to do this, but the lawyers, as you're saying, having the courage and the resolve to stand up and fight for these particular clients.
I agree. Civil rights cases are unbelievably hard when you challenge law enforcement. And you compound that with the fact that these are people in custody who have committed crimes. And you further compound that with the fact that in this case, they were the uniformly viewed as the most dangerous inmates in Men's Central Jail. So people don't want to touch these cases. And they're so worried that a jury would never believe the testimony of an inmate over a law enforcement official. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, this is why we became lawyers. I mean, this is what I went to law school for. I mean, this is what I wanted to do for a long time, to challenge authority when it's being abusive. I mean, in my closing argument, I talked about Nelson Mandela, because Nelson Mandela said, okay, I don't have the quote in front of me, but how do you view a society? You don't view a society by the lives of the privileged. You view a society by those who have the least power, who are the most disenfranchised. And nobody is more disenfranchised and less powerful than inmates in a custodial facility. So I really hope that other lawyers are empowered by this ruling, and I hope the County of Los Angeles is not only looking to change the ways of its sheriff's department, but looking to resolve cases rather than just create unnecessary litigation and depleting county resources.
All right, Ron Kay, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with attorney Ron Kay. Ron was the lawyer for five prisoners at the L.A. County Men's Jail who filed suit after being beaten and tortured by sheriff's deputies while in custody, and a judge recently awarded over $5 million in attorney fees to Ron, and Ron was here to talk about the case and the significance of it all. And I want to let you know, if you want to find out more about it, you want to dig into more about the role of the police, why they do what they do, why this system requires them, go to revcom.us. You can catch the dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, in which Avakian speaks a lot to the role of the police. You can see a lot of other things on there from him about the police. And you can also go to Stop Mass Incarceration Network. All right, so go to those two places and you'll learn a whole hell of a lot. Your eyes will be open, your head will be popping, all right? And we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. And that was Coleman Hawkins with Blues Whale. A lot of blues today because that's sort of the way things are shaping up, the way they feel right now. On New Year's Eve, a 34-year-old woman, a young woman, Myra Cornejo, who was a person who really enjoyed life and loved to have fun. She was gunned down in Compton, California. And she was gunned down by police who shot her 7 times and left her laying there. joining us to talk about this. It's just a horrible, horrible thing. And we're going to get into more of the details of the story in the course of this segment of the show. And joining us to talk about what happened is Myra's cousin, Maria Flores. Maria, welcome to the show.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Why don't you tell people what happened? How did Myra end up getting killed at a gas station in Compton by the police?
From what we've gathered from eyewitness news and information that we were told from her family, is we're still trying to figure everything out, but I'll just give you guys a little background information. My cousin was married to this man for 17 years, which is her husband. They had 5 kids together, 3 boys and 2 girls. Her 8-year-old daughter had told her that her daddy had touched her, so she was scared to say anything because he had threatened her. She was instantly just furious, and she filed a police report against him. He was only detained for 2 days because the case was rejected for the lack of evidence and witnesses. By the time she got to the court, where they were supposed to have a meeting at 2 p.m., he had already been released, and she was instantly so afraid. She hurried back home. She took her kids to her sister's house so they could be safe, and she took a gun with her for self-defense. She had just accused this guy of rape, and now he was free. She was so afraid for her children's lives and her own. But she still felt that she needed to confront this man, since authorities hadn't been able to do anything for her. She actually met up with him in front of the court, which is also outside the gas station. The court's right in front. She wanted to confront him in public so everyone could see the injustice and everyone could understand her fear of this man. From what we've heard from other eyewitnesses and videos that have came forward to us is that they were fighting and, you know, there was punching, there was kicking. And during that confrontation, he took the gun out of her pocket and checked to see if it was a threat. He saw that it had no bullets and it was also locked. I mean, the original call to law enforcement was that a man was armed. So that was during the time that he had the gun with him. The only reason she had this gun was for intimidation, since she was afraid for her own life. And just in case things were going to get dangerous for her, she needed something. He put the gun on the floor, and she picked it up and pointed it at him. By the time the cops arrived, with no negotiation or knowledge of the situation, by the time she was able to look over her shoulder, they fired 7 shots and left her dead on the floor like an animal. This man was also asked to get on the ground. They were both taken away. Sadly, my cousin was dead. She was released by law enforcement, and her family wasn't informed of what had happened for 12 hours. This happened around 4 p.m. Her family didn't find out till 4 in the morning. I mean, it was New Year's Eve day. You know, we were all celebrating New Year's Eve with our funny hats and whistles, and my poor cousin was dead. Detectives didn't even tell us that she had been killed by the officers. All they said was that Myra had a confrontation with her husband and that she had died. Mm. We all thought we were going to blame the husband. That's what we thought initially. But further investigation, we found out that it was actually law enforcement who had killed her.
Man, just a gut-wrenching and horrifying story. You know, one of the things, too, with the children, I understand that Myra also found out that her husband was not only molesting the 8-year-old daughter, but also her 4-year-old daughter as well.
Yeah, this information didn't come out till after she was. Mm-hmm. We took the kids to court, and there the nurses did a further investigation, although it was a little too late, clearly. They found out that not only was he raping the 8-year-old daughter, but also the 4-year-old daughter. And not one time. This had been going on for 2 years now. Mm. Just that the girls were so threatened and afraid to say anything that they couldn't even speak out. And the day that she did, that's the day her mother was killed. So. Mm.
Oh, man. Now, also, the police went to a relative's house where the children were staying, right, and took the children away. And has the family been able to get them back yet?
Right now, the case was cold during this time, so getting the kids was a difficulty, but right now we currently do have the kids. Her sister currently has the kids. But further information on charges that will be being brought up in near future, I can't really talk about, just in case this man decides to get away.
Sure, definitely. Now, one of the things, too, is it must have had such a terrible impact on the children. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, the impact that this, just the pileup of things, and then to find your mother was so brutally executed by the police.
Yeah, I mean, we have heard that about 2 days ago, they finally told the kids what had happened. She had five kids. One of them was 15, 13, 10, 8, and 4. Once the 15-year-old found out, he went into instant shock and was suicidal. He had to be in the hospital for 2 days. He finally came out yesterday because the hospital was just so afraid for his own life. And we have also found out that the 8-year-old little daughter, the one who told her mom that her dad had abused her, asked her aunt if it was her fault that her mommy was dead. Was it because what I told mommy? Is that why mommy's dead? It's something that they're going to have to live with for the rest of their life. Just like a lot of other people have to live with this injustice, that it's just becoming a social norm.
Man. And I'm telling you, it's hard to maintain my composure here. The horror of this, and the just the enraging aspect of it, the horror of it, the whole story being told, you know, and another aspect to it, I want people to get a sense of this too, because we talk about an epidemic, a genocidal epidemic of wanton police murder of black and brown people. And one of the things that actually has developed here, and I thought was really, that came out in the course of this this story, was that the cops not only ripped away Myra's life, and it was, by the way, people who think the sheriffs might be, you know, a little better or something. This was the LA County sheriffs. This was at Compton. Yeah. That's who patrols Compton, okay? And it was the sheriffs, and people got enough sense to know what the sheriffs are about. In 2007, there was another instance that your family, where your family had a run-in with the police. Can you tell what was happening there?
That information, that story, I'm not 100% sure of, simply because I wasn't as close to this person as I am with cousin, but it was the same, my same aunt, and it was her brother, the one, my cousin's brother who had died, so it was the same exact family. And it was also a much, I think, grimier story to imagine. I mean, there's evidence that they put a bag over his head while they were beating him, and they beat him to death. It wasn't shots, it was kicks, it was punches. My family fought a long litigation for that, but did end up winning that case.
It's incredible. I know I read that he was beaten to death in Ramona Gardens, which is a place where the police constantly terrorize people. And I can't help but think of your aunt. And she's now lost two children at the hands of just murderous police, you know. And it's hard to fathom how somebody keeps on going in the face of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to understand that, you know, my cousin's murder, it just simply sounds redundant now. You know, once again, law enforcement has killed an innocent person, and once again, they will try to justify it by any means possible. And society shouldn't deem police brutality and murder a social norm. We should all stand together and fight against this global issue. I mean, we see it all over the map, you know, with Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin. But what about all the other people that we never hear anything about, you know? I don't want this murder just to be forgotten like many others. Like, standing there at the vigil for my cousin's murder, I hear a lot of people coming up to me and saying, my cousin, my brother, my sister, something also got killed. It's just, we don't see it on TV. But it's something that's happening every day. Uniforms and badges do not make murder legal. So we all need to be responsible, and law enforcement should be held to the highest standards possible. And this can't be something that's okay anymore. You know, it's not even a race card anymore. It's not a teenage black kid that gets killed anymore. It's anyone is at the risk of being murdered by law enforcement, because law enforcement simply can find a way to justify anything they do, including a mother of five children who was only protecting her kids because they had been raped.
I'm going to have to move on at a certain point, because there's something I want to talk about in relation to this. You're welcome to stay on and listen to what I talk about here. But can you tell people what's actually happening with Myra's case right now. Not the case, but in terms of the fight to get justice for Myra. And I know that, you know, like from everything I've read about Myra, she was a remarkable younger woman. I mean, I think this whole point about what she did, how you've described her, is always happy for whenever people had good things going on in her life, she was always looking out for other people. And now she was shot down in cold blood, left to die on a gas station tarmac. And what's the scene now? Are there demonstrations going on?
Every night we are getting together at the same place in front of the Compton Courthouse at the gas station, Chevron across the street. We get together every night from 6 to 7 p.m. And what we're doing is we're protesting and we're marching to the police department and we're asking for answers. Every single night we're doing this and we're not going to stop until we get justice. Yesterday, we actually had a meeting with the officers who wanted to meet up with us to conversate and answer questions that we wanted to have answered. We met up at a church, and once we got there, once we started asking questions, they weren't able to answer anything. We asked questions like, why did you take 12 hours to inform us that my cousin was killed? And they said, that information is still under investigation. We can't let you know. Everything I wanted to know, they weren't able to answer. So I'm not sure why they are pretending that this is moving forward when they don't have any answers for us. This case is still cold. Getting the body, getting autopsies, getting all of that is just being so hard for us. And that's why we're there fighting for justice every night from 6 to 7 p.m. protesting. But we are there all day. I mean, our family is standing there possibly right now. We're there all day because we're not going to stop until we get answers and justice. And until that man is behind bars as well.
All right, Maria, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And stay strong, and hopefully I'll see you someday. I'll meet you someday. But thank you very much for joining us. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Now I'm going to go into something here. I think you heard Maria talking about this. This has to stop. I think it absolutely has to stop. There has to be an appropriate response that will make it stop, an appropriate response coming from you, from the people. All right. I want you to listen to something right now. Just listen to this real quick. It's a short little snippet, but I think it says something that I want to talk with you about.
All you celebrities out there who poured ice water on your head, here's a chance to do something else. I challenge all of you to sing the We Ain't Gonna Stop Till People Are Free song. Here we go. I can hear my neighbor crying, I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. Come on, sing it out.
All right, that was Samuel Jackson issuing a challenge to people, the people that I want to talk to right now. You know, there needs to be an appropriate response. These savage murders must stop. They must stop now. They're slaughtering our youth, and it has to stop. We cannot allow it to continue. And this involves everyone. This involves everyone, no matter what nationality you are. If you have an ounce of humanity in you, these are your youth that they're wantonly killing. We have got to step up and stop it. We've got to step up, step out, and stop it now. In a way, I'm talking to all of you out there, but I really want to especially talk to the artists, the musicians, the painters, the actors, the directors, the filmmakers. I want to talk to you about stomping the earth, about doing what you do best, stomping the earth, breaking open the sky, cracking open the skies, and responding in an appropriate way to this, helping to build a scene where this kind of savage treatment of people is ended, is stopped. Think about it. You are in a unique position to make a big impact on society by stepping out right now. And that's what Samuel Jackson was calling on you to do. This is one way to do it, to sing that song. Not doing this actually weakens the movement. It's not like if you don't do it, things will go along and it'll be okay, it'll be fine. No, it actually weakens the movement. Now, you just heard Sam Jackson challenge you. Now, I'm doing the same thing. You have been too quiet, too silent, and this has to change now. Some have raised that if they step out, they'll get hit back, that their career might suffer. Let me repeat, the police all over the country and the system they serve and protect are wantonly murdering our youth. It should be clear that fear for career is no excuse for staying silent. It's not the question. The fundamental issue here, the basic question, is one of morality. Whether we stand silent or stand up to stop this police murder has everything to do with what kind of people we are, with what kind of world we want to live in and pass on to the future humans. We do not want to be standing sometime in the future saying we coulda, we shoulda done something. We've heard that damn song too often. We've seen that film too many times. So I'm challenging you now. I'm throwing my voice in with Samuel Jackson. Sing that song. Record yourself doing it. Spread it around. Sing it in the most inappropriate of places and the most needed places. Get others to do the same. Write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Send me a link and I'll help spread it around myself. Sisters and brothers, those of us who have the platform in society where what we say and do can influence millions, can profoundly impact this movement to end police murder. You, we have to step up today. It's on us. What kind of person are you? What kind of world do you want? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. MichaelSlate@redfuture.com. That's where you can send me the link of you performing that song and write to me whenever you want. We're going to go out now with the Peace Poets song, I Can't Breathe, the one that everybody should be singing. Step up, folks. Step up, you people that got the platform. Make a damn difference.
I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We called it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We call it out the violence of these racist police. And we ain't gonna stop till our people are free. We ain't gonna stop till our people are free. I still hear my brother crying, I can't breathe. So now I'm in the struggle singing, I can't leave. We're calling out the violence of these racist police.